reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel Tuesday displayed a recovered Iranian ballistic missile it intercepted during the unprecedented attack on Israel Saturday and Sunday. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Israel's military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, held a news briefing in front of one of the missiles. He said each missile carried 500 kilos of explosives in its warhead, and Iran had fired 110 of them at Israel. He credited an international coalition led by the U.S. with stopping most of the attacks last weekend. Hagari promised a response from Israel.
Firing 110 ballistic missiles directly to Israel will not get scot-free. We will respond in our time, in our place, in the way that we will choose.
Israel's international allies have urged the nation to show restraint in its response. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
As VOA's Patsy Wadakoswara reports, Israel's response may not be as direct as an all-out military assault.
Israel could also opt for covert operations targeting Iranian officials or cyber attacks like the 2010 Stuxnet malware. Gregory Hatcher of White Knight Labs cybersecurity consultancy via Zoom.
They created a virus and then they injected it into an Iranian nuclear facility. It actually made the centrifuges spin uncontrollably and destroyed like millions of dollars and slowed down the nuclear capabilities of Iran.
Whatever option Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decides on, President Joe Biden has told him the U.S. will not participate in Israel's counterattack and urge de-escalation. Patsy Wadakoswara, VOA News, Washington.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres again called for an urgent de-escalation of hostilities at a phone conversation with Iran's foreign minister following Tehran's weekend attack on Israel. UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric said Tuesday that Guterres also called for a renewed focus on bringing peace. This is VOA News. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson is pushing ahead on U.S. aid for Ukraine and other allies amid growing GOP anger. As AP Sagar Magani explained, Johnson's thin Republican majority is against sending the aid, which would force him to rely on Democrats to help.
Kentucky's Thomas Massie says he's had enough.
We need a speaker who is not doing everything Chuck Schumer wants.
Republicans in the room during a private meeting say Massie suggested Johnson should resign or risk a vote to oust him.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion.
Johnson says he knew it would be a tough job.
I regard myself as a wartime speaker.
And says he will move forward with votes to send aid to Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, though his multi-part plan leaves out a key GOP priority, southern border security. Sagar Magani, Washington.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning this week against fresh hostilities in Sudan's North Darfur region. Reuters correspondent David Doyle reports.
Antonio Guterres was speaking on Monday, the one-year anniversary of the war between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. He said RSF-affiliated militias had attacked and burnt villages west of El Fasher, and that escalating hostilities on the outskirts of North Darfur's provincial capital were a fresh cause for deep alarm. Guterres also said that indiscriminate attacks, killing, injuring, and terrorizing civilians could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. International donors met in Paris on Monday to pledge humanitarian support for Sudan. French President Emmanuel Macron said 2 billion euros had been raised for Sudan.
Myanmar's former leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from prison to house arrest. Government said Wednesday the move was made as a health measure due to a heat wave. A nationwide conflict in Myanmar began after the army in 2021 ousted the elected government. In prison, Suu Kyi began suppressing nonviolent protests that sought a return to democratic rule. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has ordered the closure of his country's embassy and consulates in Ecuador in solidarity with Mexico and its protests over raid by the Ecuadorian authorities of the Mexican embassy. Maduro also says that Venezuela also fully supports Mexico's request to have the United Nations suspend Ecuador from the world body. Maduro spoke during a virtual meeting of the leaders of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states. The Ecuadorian president, Daniel Noboa, ordered authorities to raid the Mexican diplomatic outpost April 5th to arrest the country's former vice president, Jorge Glass. I'm Tommy McNeil, the only man.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 17, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya tenders his resignation.
There is an ongoing, renewed scramble for Libya, for its territory used as military confrontations by different foreign actors, but also Libyan armed groups.
We also speak with a Libyan-American businessman who left Libya on Tuesday. The State Department spokesperson discusses U.S. assistance to Sudan, Sudanese child refugees long for peace as they try to cope with losses. Nigeria's president says his country will no longer pay ransom to armed gangs. A member of Charles May opposition discusses campaigning for the May 6th election.
We are not counting on anybody's funding because we believe that anyone who believes in justice and equality for all should be on our side, and luckily for us, millions of children are vouching for us.
And President Biden and former President Trump support Israel's fight against Hamas and Iran. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The special representative of the Secretary General for Libya and the head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, also known as UNSMIL, Abdoulaye Bathily, says that he has submitted his resignation to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He said Libya is on the verge of losing its sovereignty to various foreign actors who are undermining the efforts of the UN. Here is Ambassador Bathily.
UNSMIL has made a lot of efforts under my leadership over the last 18 months. We have extensively interacted with all Libyans. They welcomed me as a bravo, and we worked together from all sides in a very inclusive manner. However, we have seen that over the last months, particularly, the situation has deteriorated in Libya on account of two major factors. The first one is the lack of political will and good faith by the major Libyan actors who are comfortable with the current stalemate which have been going on in Libya since 2011. The second factor is the emerging international dynamic and regional dynamics. Libya is today a battleground. We have seen that there is an ongoing renewed scramble for Libya, for its territory used as military confrontations by different foreign actors, but also Libyan armed groups and other security forces used politically in the conflicts inside the country. All these crises are interlinked, and over the last weeks and months, Libya is more and more on the road almost to lose its sovereignty. The UN has made all the efforts. UNSMIL has attempted to avert this situation. We needed the support of all the international and regional players to achieve meaningful results. Unfortunately, we have seen, against the backdrop of this developing crisis, parallel tracks taken by different foreign actors which undermine the effort of the UN. So long as this exists, there is no room for a solution in the future. And I feel very sorry, because in Libya, public opinion, in Libya, political parties, civil society organizations, women, tribal leaders are all impatient to see an end to this crisis. They want to regain the sovereignty of their country.
Abdullahi Batiza is the special representative of the Secretary General for Libya and the head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya. He submitted his resignation yesterday to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Yesterday, Tuesday, the head of the United Nations Support Mission in Libya, Arms Mill, Abdullahi Batiza, said he had submitted his resignation to the UN Secretary General. He said Libya was on the verge of losing its sovereignty to foreign intervention. A Libyan-American businessman who left Tripoli on Tuesday says the situation in the country is fluid and full of tension and tight security. Hamid Barka tells me from Istanbul, Turkey, that Libyan banks are also out of money.
The corruption is happening in Libya by unidentified sources, and things are very, very fluid in the streets. That's why I left a little earlier, because I didn't know what the outcome. I left like a week before I'm supposed to leave. It's intense. Security is very tight. The university is taken over by a group of militias. Everybody is flexing their muscles. And the people in Libya, they didn't even have money to buy clothes for their children. When I drive by the banks, there is lines outside. There is no money in the banks. The meeting between Abdul Hakim, Bilhaj, Beiba, and all the billionaires in Libya trying to beg each other to put the money back in the banks. They took all the money from the banks. I have met with several bank managers. They swear to me they don't have a penny in the banking system. All the cash is out of the banking system. It is the biggest corruption of money laundering. I have sent you the chart of the money laundering, and there are people in the Libyan government and intelligence services, they can vouch for this information.
So Mr. Batili says that Libya is sliding more and more into chaos and is becoming a prey to foreign interference. Did you notice that?
Yes, I did notice that, because I've seen military taking a place, because all my colleagues work for the air traffic control. They graduated in 1984 from the United States. I've been monitoring the traffic. The traffic is very heavy from different organizations, Americans, Italians, and the Turkish. Libya right now, and the people in the street, they don't even have food.
You said you just left Libya.
I left this morning. I even paid extra to leave. I paid $550 to get on the early flight, because I don't want to stay any longer, because I see there is a danger in Libya. It could shut down any moment.
Hamid Barka is a Libyan-American businessman based in Atlanta, Georgia. He was speaking with me from Istanbul, Turkey. Libyan authorities were not immediately available for a reaction. This week, international donors pledged $2.1 billion for war-ravaged Sudan. State Department spokesperson William Schmonsis spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Eric Manirikasi Kisa about the U.S. assistance to Sudan, with translation by VOA's Douglas Umpuga.
Ça fait un an qu'une guerre civile totale s'est éclatée au Sudan. C'est une lutte de pouvoir entre deux généraux.
He says it's been a year since an all-out civil war broke out in Sudan. It's a power struggle between two generals, which has already killed thousands of civilians, displaced 8 million people, and brought even more at the brink of starvation. In fact, it's the biggest humanitarian catastrophe currently unfolding on the planet. 25 million people are in need of humanitarian aid. Of course, there are shortages of goods, services, and food all over Sudan. Yesterday in Paris, at the International Humanitarian Conference on Sudan, the United States pledged an additional $100 million. This includes emergency food aid, nutrition support, and other vital assistance. This announcement brings total U.S. humanitarian aid to $1 billion. The United States remains the largest donor to Sudan and its neighboring countries. The aid is being used to provide medical services, sanitation, humanitarian assistance, and aid refugees in neighboring countries as a result of the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
That was U.S. State Department spokesperson William Schmonsis, with translation by VOA's Douglas Umpuga. The ongoing violence in Sudan has had a significant negative impact on children, some of whom were traumatized and separated from their parents as they fled to safety in neighboring countries. Sheila Pony reports from Rank, a border town between Sudan and South Sudan, where some of the displaced children are living with strangers forced to act as temporary foster parents out of necessity.
A beautiful baby, whom we shall call Deborah, was barely 1 month old when the war broke out in Sudan a year ago. 1 year later, no one knows her exact date of birth. Unfortunately, her biological mother, the only person who could have done that, is missing. A 20-year-old refugee, Gufran Hamed Al-Nur, has taken responsibility for Deborah. I feel pity for her for the things we went through in Sudan, she says as she cuddles Deborah, tears dropping on her chisel-like cheeks. The two are sitting on an old hospital bed in one of the hospital facilities at a transit camp for refugees here in Reng, a South Sudanese town near the border with Sudan. Today they came here for a checkup because baby Deborah wasn't feeling well. Deborah was carried out of Sudan by a woman who was fleeing violence. At the border, the charity Save the Children International took custody of her and later handed her to Gufran, a young lady whose life was disrupted by the Sudan war.
I will raise her like my daughter, Gufran says.
On April 11th of last year, a 12-year-old boy who we will call John traveled from Kenya to Khartoum, where he had planned to spend his holiday with his parents. 3 days later, fighting broke out, and by the following day, he lost both parents to the war.
I stayed with my parents for 3 days. The 4 days, they start fighting. My mother and my father, they go to fight for work. They kill my parents.
These are the sad tales of Sudanese children who are paying the price of a year-long conflict in Sudan that has claimed thousands of lives and torn families apart. Ponpon Jit, director of Save the Children's operation in South Sudan, said the majority of those fleeing the war in Sudan are under age 18.
Since the war broke out in Sudan, over 600,000 arrivals in total of both returnees and refugees have arrived in South Sudan through Jordan border in Rank. Over 300,000, which is basically over 50% of the total arrivals, are children. A lot of them also came unaccompanied or separated.
John and nearly all the children at the camp don't attend school. Most of these children spend their time at this safe space built by Save the Children and partners, a big field at a transit point in Reng, where they run around playing football and doing artwork. Sheila Oponi, VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Buffy in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 17. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu says the country will no longer pay ransom to armed gangs that have plagued Nigeria with kidnapping and extortion. He made the statement as activists commemorated the 10th anniversary of the infamous kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls from the town of Chibok. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
President Bola Tinubu's opinion piece for Newsweek magazine titled 10 Years Since Chibok, Nigeria Will No Longer Pay the Price, was published Monday. In it, Tinubu said ransom payments to gangs only encouraged gangs to commit more crimes and said, quote, the extortion racket must be squeezed out of existence, end quote. The president said, instead of ransom, perpetrators of the violence will receive the security services' counteractions. He cited the recent rescue of 137 school students kidnapped in Kaduna State. Their abductors had demanded $600,000 in ransom, but the president said no ransom was paid. Ndungokolo, managing partner at Next Year, public advisory firm with focus on security and economic issues, agrees that ransom payment emboldens perpetrators but says Nigeria is not ready to take such stance.
The Nigerian state is obviously very weak to even do those things he says he wants to do. So if you are someone who you have your person already kidnapped, and obviously you know that the state security agents cannot do anything, so how come you're able to retrieve those number of kids, two kids, without shooting a gun? And you are telling us you didn't pay any ransom. And we knew that those guys demanded ransom. So the entire thing shows that there's no honesty, there's no transparency.
Tinubu said the government's response to the Chibok abduction in 2014 was slow. But the president said Nigeria must recognize the changing nature of the threat. He said criminal gangs behind more recent kidnappings are primarily after cash rewards, unlike Boko Haram, which sought to impose Islamist rule. In 2022, Tinubu's predecessor, Muhammadu Buhari, tried to criminalize ransom payments to kidnappers, but the decision was met with resistance from activists and families of victims. Security analyst Senator Iribu says lack of accountability from authorities is the main concern.
There will not be ransom in the first place if measures are in order to prevent it. Why is it easy for kidnappers to kidnap Nigerians and keep them for long? Why is it that the cases are rising 10 years after the Chibok girls? It's not trying to blame victims who are desperate to try to do everything they can to rescue their loved ones. It's because citizens, for them, that may be their last resort.
Tinubu said Nigeria must ultimately address the triggers for insecurity, including poverty, inequality, and lack of opportunity. The Nigerian president ended his article by saying, quote, "There will be no more ransoms paid to kidnappers, nor towards policies which have trapped our people economically." End quote. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
An official of Chad's opposition Transformers Party says Chadians are mobilizing their personal resources to support the campaign of Prime Minister Success Masra, who is running against interim President Mohamed Idris Deby in the May 6 election. Undelembai Yaseda, Transformers Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora, says that Masra is not getting funding from the government or from outside sources. He tells me that millions of Chadians are gravitating to Masra's grassroots campaign.
I believe the campaign is going very well on our side. People are all excited, and we are right now doing the Maliku Transformateur, which basically means hello, Transformers. So we deploy since Sunday all of our militants to go door to door, knock at people's door and say hello to them and present themselves to them. Tell them about May 6th election and encouraging them to come out and vote for us. So it's going perfectly well.
How does it feel for Mr. Masra to be campaigning, I would say, against the military leader who just appointed him the prime minister?
I believe that's the definition of democracy. It's the freedom of choice. Being a prime minister doesn't keep him from running for the higher office. Everybody's doing their own campaign. The president is running his campaign, and we are running our own. And we trust the people of Chad to decide who should be the pilot of the next destination of the Chad based on the justice and equality for all.
Let's assume he wins. Is he comfortable, or is he certain that the military can really give up power?
I believe we will have something new to show in Chad, given that many people thought he shouldn't be even a candidate because he is a prime minister, and yet he is. And now he's running against the president, and not only the president, but against 8 other candidates. And we're certainly going to win because we are speaking in the heart of the people, and we are in their hearts. Once we win, we will be working with anybody, from military to civilian, because this is not about military. This is about the people of Chad. And the people of Chad have military within them. So we are not going to speculate on if they let us lead the country, because they are powerful as well as we do for justice and equality for all. So
where is Mr. Masra getting his funding for the campaign? Is it from the government?
We are not getting funding from the government. It is from our constituents. We are doing a fundraising on the grassroots level, and people are pitching in, giving us their own resources, their cars, whatever they have to offer us, food or drinks. This is a collective effort, and this shows how the people of Chad want change. We do not have state aid. We do not have external funding. We are relying purely on our own militant and on our own resources to organize this campaign. This is a very, very modest campaign we're having, and simply because our message has taken heart on the people of Chad, everyone is mobilizing their own resources to put into our disposition in order to run this campaign. So we are not counting on anybody's funding, because we believe that anyone who believes in justice and equality for all should be on our side. And luckily for us, millions of Chadians are vouching for us, not only by the mouth, but also within their pockets and within their and from the wealth and whatever else they have. Some offer the car, some offer the house, some offer clothing, some offer water, some offer food. So it's amazing what's happening in Chad right now, because of so many years, so many decades of lack of democracy, the Chadian people are aspiring for real change, and they believe we should be the one bringing that change for them.
Mundulemba Yeseda is the Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both supporting Israel in the war in Gaza and its hostilities with Iran. VOA's correspondent Scott Stearns reports on how events in the Middle East are shaping U.S. politics.
Iran's attack on Israel and America's role in the Middle East as issues in this U.S. presidential campaign are a contest over which candidate backs Israel most. As incumbent, President Joe Biden oversaw the U.S. response to the attack and reaffirmed U.S. support for Israel in a meeting with the Iraqi prime minister.
The United States is committed to Israel's security. We're committed to a ceasefire that will bring the hostages home and preventing conflict from spreading beyond what it already has. We're also committed to the security of our personnel and partners in the region, including Iraq.
Politically, Biden is facing competing calls to do more to help secure the release of hostages held by Hamas and to get tougher with Israel over its attacks in Gaza. His opponent, Donald Trump, says none of the violence in the Middle East would have happened if he were still president, without explaining how.
I want to say God bless the people of Israel. They're under attack right now. That's because we show great weakness. This would not happen. The weakness that we've shown is unbelievable, and it would not have happened if we were in office. You know that. They know that. Everybody knows that.
The Trump campaign is working to portray Biden as weak on Israel on Trump's social media platform and through Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Joe Biden has transformed into an anti-Israel president. There's really no other way to characterize it. He's more concerned seemingly with placating the anti-Semitism in his base than standing with our historic and vitally important ally.
In the Midwestern state of Michigan, voter Carol Plissner says Biden needs to keep up his support for Israel.
I think initially President Biden's response to the situation was helpful and it was supportive. I think as time has gone on, that's become more questionable. And I think that the United States needs to have a stance that's deeply protective of democracy across the world. And that means deeply respectful of Israel.
Biden's support for Israel in Gaza is reason to oppose him, says Michigan voter Mohammed Mawri.
He's complicit in a catastrophe that's happening 1,000 miles away. People think that it's not hurting us, but it is. We're aiding it with our money.
Polling by Pew Research last month showed deep divides on the issue, with about 20% of U.S. voters saying Biden's striking the right balance, another 20% saying he's favoring Israel, and 16% saying he's favoring Palestinians. The largest group in that poll was not sure how well Biden's handling the issue. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
That's it for this Wednesday, April 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day. Yeah.